are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Missouri National Education Association and the Greater Kansas City Building and Construction Trades Council. The Missouri NEA serves as the united voice of educators and advocates for the rights of students, educators, and working families across Missouri. The 32,000 members of the Missouri National Education Association work each day to inspire students' love of learning and ensure every child, regardless of zip code, can attend a great public school. The Kansas City Building Trades Council, that's the men and women who build KC. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, wine and aspirin sales are up all over for parents. What's to blame? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to sing the virtual school blues. Then, what? A political party based on worker rights and fair wages for all? We'll talk to Mark Dudzik, who is a major leader of the Labor Party that almost was. In the news, despite the GDP, it's still a depression for millions of American workers. And steelworkers want the Trump administration to stand for labor rights in Mexico. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg. And now for the news. While Republicans try to put lipstick on today's headlines about a record-shattering rise in the annualized 30% in GDP in the third quarter, the reality of a prolonged depression without aid from Congress is settling in to the working class right before the election. Trump is sure to claim this latest data proves his leadership is saving the country from the pandemic-sparked slump and raising the economy from the dead, but it just ain't so. PAI reports that it is indeed true that economic growth on this scale is truly unmatched in U.S. history. Before, the best quarter ever was way back in 1950, when there was a quarterly annualized gain of 16.7%, far less than the 30% of this last quarter. But before anyone is tempted to give Trump or the Republicans credit, it's important to examine this 30% number in more detail. A quick look at the situation facing millions of working families, along with some simple arithmetic, will show us right away Trump's tale of strong growth just doesn't add up. But Trump is hoping we won't do the math. In fact, the fact is we are still in the middle of an economic depression unlike anything seen since the 1930s. Almost 25 million people are still collecting unemployment, and millions more have already been kicked off state aid and are struggling to survive. The much-hyped growth of the third quarter, July through September, comes right after a disastrous second quarter April to June, when the economy shut down to control the spread of the pandemic, and total output of goods and services in the United States plummeted nearly 32%, the most devastating period of collapse ever. Things would have been even worse, of course, without the CARES Act, which included the $600 unemployment supplement, the Paycheck Protection Program, and the $1,200 stimulus checks, the student debt moratorium, and other public loan and aid programs, most of which have now expired. The third quarter, by contrast, saw businesses partially reopen in many parts of the country, and thus a partial revival of economic activity. But that was before the fall month. A resurgence of COVID, and again put the chill on the economy. We'll only find out the statistics of how bad things are right now with the next report in January. Consider those second and third quarter rates again. Imagine our whole economy is worth $100. When we have a 32% decline in one quarter, the economy is now worth $68. That's the new base. So a 30% growth rate brings us back to $88.40 after a year. If everything continues as is, which is a drop of 12%, which before COVID would have been considered earth-shaking. Boil it down, and contrary to what Trump and the Republicans claim, the numbers show an economy that is still in dire straits with no clear path to recovery under their management. With the expiration of the CARES Act, things are actually getting worse at this very moment.
Last summer, Mexican labor lawyer Susana Prieto Terrazas was arrested on trumped-up charges in Matamoros after she counseled maquiladora export workers working for the United States and other foreign factories about returning to work without protection from COVID. Prieto has a long history of defending workers against their corrupt employers and unions. This week, United Steelworkers President Thomas Conway, who is the chairperson of the Labor Advisory Committee for Trade Negotiation and Policy, sent a letter to Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, Labor Secretary Eugene Scalia, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, saying that he is very concerned about the criminal charges that have been filed against Prieto Terrazas by the state governments of Chihuahua. After several weeks in jail, Prieto was released and sent back to the state of Chihuahua to Ciudad Juarez, across the river from El Paso, Texas, where Prieta has lived. She was barred from defending her clients. Now the authorities are trying to bring charges in Chihuahua and have ordered her to appear in court this week, where it is likely that she will again be detained and incarcerated. Her request to have the hearings online was denied despite documentation from her physician that she continues to suffer effects of COVID-19 and is also recovering from a recent knee surgery. Conway concludes, "These actions appear to be calculated to send a message to workers and their advocates that any attempt to exercise rights guaranteed under the USMCA, that's the new NAFTA, and Mexico's labor law reforms will be harshly suppressed. I urge you to communicate these concerns to the Mexican authorities."
And that's the news. The news tonight was read by Chris Mann, and I'm Judy Ansel.
This computer. All right. My name is Cortland Smith with the Heartland Labor Forum, and today I have Gina Kelling, first grade teacher at Kip Endeavor Academy. I want to thank you for appearing on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Of course, you know, a lot of students in this time have been a part of virtual learning because we want to make sure to curb the COVID-19 outbreak, of course, in Kansas City, but across the nation. So actually my first question, so we can educate our listeners, is describe what virtual school looks like or entails for you as a teacher and possibly the student.
Yeah, I mean, I think it looks different at every school. I know a lot of teachers at other schools. So this is my experience at my school, and this experience varies teacher by teacher. But essentially, the way our school does it is we have two different waves where students log on to Zoom, and they are on from 9 to 12 or from 1 to 4. And basically, we're fitting all of the instruction into that time, and students are actually receiving live instruction for that entire period. So as a teacher, that means you're teaching the same content two times a day. As a student, you're obviously only logging on to one call, but it's crazy to be able to fit that the instruction that you should into that smaller amount of time. It almost takes even more planning, even though you're planning for less minutes. And the, at least for me last year, I'm a first grade teacher, so I don't really use a lot of technology in my class typically, like in a normal year. So getting used to making sort of virtual resources for students and families to use, and then also for me to teach from, has ended up taking, at least me, and maybe I'm just real slow, a lot of extra time per week for a student. I mean, I can only speak to what's happening in my classroom. I think it's hard for adults to be on Zoom for 3 hours straight. So for 6 and 7 year olds, it's like, it's pretty wild. It's pretty wild for them to be online for that whole time. And we do a lot of dance breaks. We do a lot of yoga breaks. We do a lot of just step away from your computer and close your eyes for 2 minutes breaks. So you just reset. But that's pretty much what the days look like in terms of online learning.
Okay, that's interesting. You know, as a fourth grade teacher, we're a little bit different, but I think we all agree that 3 hours on Zoom is a whole lot harder than people know. Next, has the reality of teaching virtually matched up with how you thought it would be before school began?
Like before the school year started, when I envisioned virtual teaching, has that matched up?
Yes, ma'am.
I think in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. I taught summer school virtually as well, like right after we had gone, I mean, I guess after just a couple of months of being in quarantine, while things were still really fresh, and summer school was horrible. It was truly horrible. I did not feel like I was teaching students at all. Like they were logging in and they're like checking off a box, and it just didn't feel purposeful. So I didn't want to carry that cynicism into the new year, but I had a lot of doubts that students would get anything out of it. The reality was, like, students are growing virtually. They're just growing at a much slower rate than you would see if you were in person with them. The things that, like, don't change have surprised me. Like, for me, first graders are just as hilarious and charming and brilliant over Zoom as they are in person. And in some ways, like the intimacy of being a part of someone's home cultivates deeper relationships quicker because you're right there in their living room and you hear their grandma yelling at them. And I'm like, yeah, I'm backing up grandma. I need you to sit up tall and like, let's get learning. So in some ways, it's kind of an amazing way to start a school year because you do get to see intimately what a student's home life looks like and get to be a part of their home life in so many ways. And in other ways, it's obviously super challenging and you want students to be learning faster, especially given like this massive gap that happened in instruction from like spring break of last year to the start of this year, especially for like a first grader. Like these months are like normally when students are like skyrocketing because like the learning happens so quickly and they grow so quickly, but to see it happen so slowly is kind of heartbreaking in a lot of ways.
So you've actually mentioned some positive things, such as, you know, getting a higher level of intimacy with your students, and some negative things as far as, you know, growth rate. What are some of the weaknesses that you have seen or during or through virtual learning?
I mean, I think there's no way to effectively monitor, at least for first grade, like if a student is independently doing anything. For so many students, like there's a parent, grandparent, aunt, older sibling next to them, helping them do things where, like, if this was happening in the classroom, this would be a time for them to practice by themselves a new skill. So many students aren't actually getting the practice time they need to work on skills in order to, like, get to the next level. Additionally, obviously, if you're at home, even when you're working at home, there's like a million more distractions than if you're at work. And so that's totally out of your control as a teacher. And all you can do is harness a student's like drive to learn, which is asking a lot, I think, of elementary students in particular, who are like placed in a spot in their house and just told to like get their work done. So I think it's really, really challenging to battle those things. The other thing is, like, there's not really the space or time for individualized instruction like you would have during a school day. So, like, if a student was struggling with a concept, you might be like, okay, we'll touch back in an hour on this, and I'll, like, pull them into a small group, or I'll pull them one-on-one to, like, give them more individual attention and instruction. And in 3 hours of time, like, there's simply, that's just not possible.
Well, we don't want, you know, even as a teacher myself, and I talk about the negatives, but I don't want the people to think there it's all negatives. Are there any successes or any strengths that you see through virtual learning?
Yeah, I mean, I think like families are able to see what their student is actually learning and how the teacher is teaching it. So they're able to better support students when they do work on things at home. Oftentimes you like send home a packet and, you know, the family might call and be like, this is a first grade packet and I have no idea like how my student is supposed to do this. But if I'm in your living room, you're hearing me explain it and you're hearing how your student should probably work on it then. I mean, the other thing is just like access to families. Like if a student is having a hard time, I'm like, I need you to go grab a helper. Like we need to have a conversation. And so like, it's so instant. And I think that in turn, like all of those things combined actually build like a lot deeper trust between families and teachers than I've ever experienced before. Because like, there's no other time where I would be able to have 20 parents in my room watching me teach. And so this allows them the opportunity to see what I'm like and for us to build trust together. I think there's like other competencies that first graders are learning that I probably wouldn't emphasize otherwise, like in terms of technology, but I mean, obviously those are good things too. And it's good that students are learning these. I personally would like less time on technology. So I know it's a good thing. And it just pains me to say that.
Well, again, I want to say thank you for being on the show. And then could you, like, with the small amount of time we have left, could you just say what is one thing you would say to parents or students about virtual learning?
Man, I mean, I think like I would hope and encourage them to like take a similar mantra to me. I don't know. This is what I do to get through my days is like, do what you can with you can while you can with what you can. Like right now, nothing is perfect. But if you are trying your best, if you are showing up every day ready to grow, then that's good. That's great. That's exactly what needs to be done.
Well, again, I want to thank you for being on the show. And we appreciate your views and, well, just telling us how virtual learning is going, strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Record to this. All right. So this is Cortland Smith back with the Heartland Labor Forum. And our next guest is Miss Betsy Brogan, Assistant Principal at KIPP Endeavor Academy. I want to thank you for appearing on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as assistant principal, I want you to bring the perspective of an administrator. We've heard from a teacher, but I want you to bring the perspective of an administrator. From an administrative point of view, how does what does virtual school look like, or what does it entail for you?
So my day right now is a lot of Zooming into other people's Zoom calls. So I spend about 6 hours a day just observing teachers in a Zoom call to come up with action steps to be more effective or like name strengths. And then also some of that time just like troubleshooting tech issues with kids, tech issues with teachers, all of those things, just trying to be a support.
Okay. You know what?
That's what a lot of it is.
You brought up an interesting discussion, tech. How has tech been a hindrance, but has there been any positivity coming out of the increased need for tech?
Yeah, I mean, I think the spring was a huge wake-up call for at least our school. I can't speak for others. We've always been a little bit tech-averse is maybe too strong of a word, but like we've shied away from really incorporating tech and relied really heavily on like fully just teachers and humans. And I think we've learned some lessons about how you can use tech to like fill certain needs and obviously like never replace teachers, but there are things that there are opportunities on tech that we weren't capitalizing that we now get to see and use. But it's also been really hard trying to explain to a six-year-old how to log into their Clever on an iPad and type the 17 letters that is their password is difficult daily. So
that is very understandable, but maybe we could say that we're increasing the next generation's tech aptitude.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've been so amazed by what our kids can do on computers and iPads and things like that. I was on a call with a second grader last week and she showed me how you can like screen share your iPad on Zoom now, and you couldn't do that before. And I was just like, okay, thank you for showing the adult how to do something like kids are so good at. So they're definitely adapting and definitely figuring it out. So
okay, my next question is, when you thought about having virtual school this fall semester, has the reality lived up to your forethoughts?
In some ways, yes. And in some ways, no. I think the biggest thing that I didn't anticipate was student engagement struggles. It has been hard to keep kids engaged for our 3-hour live sessions. And I think I severely underestimated the effort it would take to keep them looped in, both in like planning and execution.
Yeah, that seems like a unique challenge. I mean, if we be honest, how many adults want to sit and stare at a computer for multiple hours? So asking, you know, especially elementary school age kids to do that seems like a real challenge.
Yeah.
What are some of the weaknesses that you have seen during or through virtual learning?
I think engagement is one of them. I think the ability to diagnose what a student is doing, be it interacting with tech in a way that they need help. And like, you can't see what's on their screen a lot of the time. So you don't know what they're struggling with and you don't know like how to help them. And it is really, really hard to navigate tech issues in that way. But also as they're working and mastering student work, getting eyes on the student work that they're doing has been a tremendous challenge. And I think has created some limitations in how effective we can be. I talk to people all the time about strategies and ways to get eyes on student work because that's what teachers need to see.
So, of course, we all know there's weaknesses, but you also talked about a strength, such as the second grader who taught you how to use the iPad and
Zoom, the
kids are amazing at that. So what are some strengths or some good things that you have seen come out of virtual learning?
I've seen us really interrogate and utilize our minutes with kids more efficiently. I think when you have an 8-hour school day, you take some of that time for granted. And when you have 3 hours, you have to really be careful about what you're putting in front of kids. And so it's been an opportunity to do that. Kids are way more tech literate than they were this time last year. And that's arguably one of the most important skills that we build and foster in students. And I think in addition to like tech literacy, they're learning how to be more independent than they've had to be in the past. Our kids used to be so reliant on us for everything. And now they're figuring things out for themselves. And then teachers are there to catch them when they need to be, but kids are building their independence and it's really cool to watch.
Yeah, that sounds like a paramount thing, even for some adults to build independence. Couple more questions. You know, we all hope that COVID-19 is on its way down, but clearly it doesn't look that way. And I think that with all things like this, it kind of changes our future. So what do you see envision virtual learning being as we go forth, whether that be just for the extent of COVID-19, or just for, you know, school in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I would love to see the piece around digital literacy maintain in our school, even when we can bring kids back in person. There are so many things there are so many ways tech enhances the classroom and so many benefits to kids being able to navigate technology and Word documents and the internet and so many things to learn about the world that exists online. I would love to see us keep that and incorporate it into our in-person model. And then I think, you know, in the short term, I would love to get kids back in the building, but in the short term, like as we have to stay online, I think we need to continue to think about really carefully what things are we asking kids to do with us when we're live, and what things can they do on their own. What things can we give them to do that build and continue to build that independence? And what things do we really need to be there to catch them right there live in the moment?
Well, this will be our last question. If you had one thing, you could do one or two, but one thing that you wanted to tell parents or students, whether that be, you can make it a praise, or you could just anything that you would want to tell parents and students, just as far as how about virtual learning.
Yeah. I think first and foremost, I would say thank you. Thank you for partnering with us. Thank you for, you know, helping your kids get into Seesaw and out of Seesaw and into Zoom and onto Clever. And for creating spaces where it's quiet and they can learn. All of that has been so hard and so important, and we really, really appreciate the opportunity to partner in a brand new way with our families. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And you know, it's hard, and we're doing a good job, and we're gonna keep doing a better and better job. I think that's the most important message to hear, is it's hard. And sometimes I think people get frustrated or feel like they're struggling or not doing enough, but students and families are doing a great job.
Well, again, I appreciate you being on here and giving us a point of view from an administrator. And thank you for you and all your teachers' hard work.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Smith. We appreciate you.
All right. Well, that has been it from the Heartland Labor Forum.
All right. right.
From the staff here at KKFI, we want to express our gratitude to our phone volunteers and supervisors, folks who picked up lunch and breakfast, our day managers, the producers, hosts, and DJs on the air at KKFI. A lot of you pull multiple shifts to make sure KKFI stays a vital part of the media landscape here in the Kansas City area. You are the ones making the difference. There is no KKFI without you. Thank you very much.
Kansas City Public Theater and KKFI present El Amor Que Mueve El Sol y Las Demás Estrellas, an original radio play in Spanish written and directed by Karen Lissandra, inspired by the surreal lives of revolutionary artists Leonora Carrington and Remedios Varo. Starring Julia Othmer, Fedra Cooper, and featuring original music by Amado Espinosa and Johnny Hamill. Tune in Thursday, October 29th at 7 p.m. on KKFI 90.1 FM.
We are the people who build and maintain the nation, but rarely enjoy the fruits of our labor.
We are the employed and the unemployed.
We are the people who make the country run, but have little say in running the country.
We come together to create this Labor Party to defend our interests and aspirations from the greed of multinational corporate interests.
Decades of concessions to corporations by both political parties have not produced the full employment economy we've been promised.
Instead, income and wealth disparities have widened to shameful extents.
We offer an alternative vision of a just society that values working people, their families, and communities.
We have the right to a decent paying job and a decent place to live.
We have the right to join a union freely without fear of losing our job.
We have the right not to be discriminated against because of our race, gender, ethnicity, disability, national origin, or sexual orientation at work or in our communities.
We have the right to free, quality public education for ourselves and our children.
We have the right to universal access to publicly funded, comprehensive, quality health care for all residents.
We have the right to retire at a decent standard of living after a lifetime of work.
We have the right to quality of life in our communities, enhanced by a fully funded public sector.
Good evening. I'm your host, Chris Mann. You've just heard the beginning sentences of the preamble crafted in 1996 by the newly formed Labor Party. Tonight, our topic is building a Labor Party. The preamble was read by Dennis Galley and myself. This is only a dream at this point, but from 1996 to 2007, that dream of a Labor Party was a reality. The Labor Party formation in 1996 had a constitution, a preamble, and a comprehensive program called the Economic Justice for All Workers. Our guest tonight was a former leader of the Labor Party and is with us tonight to tell us about the days when working people in the United States built a political party of our own. He'll talk about the reasons for a Labor Party and why it doesn't exist today, and describe why a Labor Party was necessary in 1996, and he'll speak to why labor needs its own party. Tonight we have Mark Dudzik. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Chris, and it was so wonderful to hear that preamble read aloud in these dark days.
Oh, my gosh. It was so beautiful. The moment I saw it, I knew I had to read that. So can you tell our listeners, fill us in a bit about your history and background?
Yes, yeah, so I was a member of a union called the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers, which is now part of the Steel Workers, and I helped, I worked in a precious metals refinery that was just newly organized and became a chief shop steward and then a local union president and then president of my district council, and I got to work with this amazing, a guy named Tony Mazzocchi, who was an amazing labor visionary, who was probably the person most responsible for the passage of the Occupational Safety and Health Act in 1970 and built some of the first labor and environmental alliances, as well as, you know, believed in independent working class politics. And he helped move our union into this fight for a labor party. And after he died in 2002, I came down to Washington, D.C. to kind of help work on the Labor Party project and then sort of following up on other projects as the Labor Party began to flounder in the early 2000s.
Okay, and so you were right there partaking in all of the workings of this. So the Labor
yes,
Party...
Yes, I was there, there at the birth.
Oh, how exciting.
So it was an exciting moment.
Yeah. So the Labor Party was founded, in 1996. And what were the social and political factors that made this possible?
So, you know, you got to look back to what was happening in the 1990s. You know, we had just emerged from this sort of reversal of the post-World War II period of economic expansion, where labor had a seat at the table. Ronald Reagan got elected in 1980. He immediately busted this PATCO strike, the flight of air traffic controllers, and there's this huge movement of union busting and the beginning of globalization and offshoring and workers and people of color and poor people were getting their butts kicked for a decade and a half. And then in 1992, we elected this guy, Bill Clinton, as a Democrat who, you know, a lot of union folks thought was going to begin to turn things around. And in fact, he didn't. And things got worse. He led the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was the first nail in the coffin of offshoring and globalization. He eliminated basic protections for the poor people, helped to criminalize the drug war and a whole series of things that really set us further back. So people were beginning to get really tired of this stuff and wanted to talk about fighting back. And at the same time, there was this movement to kind of revitalize the labor movement, and there was a fight over the presidency of the AFL-CIO. So by the mid-90s, there was a really strong kind of worker insurgency that felt that a revived labor movement could really not only help organize tens of millions of unorganized workers, but also begin to develop an independent labor politics. And out of that, we first launched a group called Labor Party Advocates, and then, as you said, in 1996, we held the founding convention for the Labor Party.
So it sounds then like workers wanted to band together at that point.
Yeah, there was a lot of both anger and hope. And, you know, that's the sort of, that's the magical combination, right? People have to understand that the status quo is untenable, and they also have to think that there's a pathway forward, that there's a solution, and that's what moves people to action. And people were moved to action in the mid-1990s. And, you know, we had, at our founding convention, we had six national unions and hundreds of local unions and regional unions represented, 1,600 delegates, you know, that passed that wonderful document that you read the preamble of. The big, broad, open debate about what the party should stand for, how we should do our politics. You know, it was a very exciting moment.
It certainly sounds that way. And so there were six unions, and what reason did other unions give not to log on to the Labor Party, not to join?
You know, I think there were multiple reasons. The main reason was that they felt that it was a dead end to try to break with the Democratic Party, and that we needed to keep our wagon hitched to the fortunes of the Democratic Party.
Okay, and that'll drive us into our next question here. Throughout the entire history of the Labor Party, you had to grapple with the spoiler issue in political campaigns. In other words, you don't want to upset the apple cart and step on the toes of the Democratic Party. How did the Labor Party handle this, and how did you try to resolve it?
Yeah, so that's a huge issue in American politics. You know, we have this two-party system that makes it really hard to have kind of a third-party challenge without creating all kinds of other unintended consequences in the political field. And unions in particular, you know, they're enmeshed in that two-party system because they rely on their political relationships for a lot of issues that are, you know, the bread and butter for their members, particularly if you represent public sector employees or you have a major concern that needs political resolution. It's hard for them to just walk away from those instrumental relationships and think about a more transformative political view. So, you know, our vision was that we would begin to slowly build momentum towards a break with the Democratic Party before we ran candidates, and that we needed to build the power to do that. We called it an organizing approach to politics, so that running candidates would be the last thing, not the first thing, that we did as a Labor Party, that we needed to build the kind of organization that could run effective campaigns from the precinct level on up, and avoid the spoiler model in order to move forward. You know, the other thing that we experimented with a little bit and never really developed momentum is to look for the kind of races where we wouldn't be a spoiler. So, for example, we actually got a ballot line in South Carolina, South Carolina Labor Party, in the early 2000s. And our vision there was, you know, the Democratic Party was so weak and ineffective that running a candidate in South Carolina would no way affect the outcome of the national political battles, but it would build, you know, it would show that you could build a party of labor in the right to work South. But by then, the sort of broader decline in the labor movement was just so becoming so deep that we couldn't even sustain those kind of initiatives. So we tried some efforts. We had, I think, a clear vision on what we needed to do. But we were never able to sort of achieve escape velocity around the spoiler issue.
So, Mark, why do you think the Democratic Party has such a grip on the labor movement?
Because they have a grip on the levers of power, political power. Mm-hmm. And labor doesn't have enough power to take their hands off those levers and put their own hands on it.
Yeah, and sometimes we don't realize our power.
That's very true.
Yeah. So, what factors led to the Labor Party's decline?
Well, I think that, you know, there was a lot of, you know, God knows we made our share of mistakes over time. But, you know, I think the objective factors that led to the decline was the fact that the labor movement as a whole wasn't capable of sustaining it. You know, there was this idea in the mid-90s that we were going to revitalize labor, we were going to organize 1 million workers a year and, you know, build this powerful new labor movement. And we lost that fight. We were defeated. You know, we weren't able to change labor law. We weren't able to build that kind of on-the-ground organizing. And without a vitalized and advancing labor movement, you just can't build a party of labor in a vacuum. So that was the primary kind of structural factor. In addition, you know, in 2000, you know, a guy named George W. Bush sort of squeezed into power by stealing the election, and then the politics really changed. You know, he inaugurated a really vicious anti-labor regime, started a war, a whole series of issues that, you know, really kind of raised the stakes in the political system and really threw us and the entire progressive movement back on a defensive mode. So, by 2005, 2006, there was really no longer any significant momentum from coming from within the labor movement to continue to pursue the Labor Party project. So we really had to put it on the shelf and kind of wait for the conditions to change.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you brought up the war in Iraq. It seems to have had an effect on the labor movement negatively. Even though the Labor Party's history was short, did it leave anything positive?
I think it left a lot positive. First of all, our program has framed what economic justice organizing should be all about. Much of it has been embraced by the Bernie Sanders campaign, for example. His plank on free higher education is taken almost verbatim from our program. You know, the Medicare for All campaign was really one of the first effective national labor-based campaigns fighting for a real single-payer healthcare system in this country. So a lot of the programmatic vision that we laid out in our documents, you know, it continues today to define what working-class politics ought to look like in this country. And then, you know, I mean, we did a lot of cultural things, films and music and plays and stuff that I think that tradition, we helped revitalize that cultural, working class cultural movements. And some of that has continued. There's a labor film festival here in Washington, D.C. that has basically become the premier labor film festival in the nation that has annual events. And, you know, a number of things like that have persisted. And then finally, our vision of building a party, which is, you know, building it, you know, based on, you know, working class interests and concerns, bringing in institutional players in the labor movement and, you know, building it, you know, from below, building power from below and not just sort of running helter-skelter political campaigns just for the sake of bearing witness or feeding our own vanities. I think that vision has also persisted very mature way to look at how working class politics needs to play out.
Yes, yes. So I can see all of the things at play that you mentioned, healthcare for all, and we want to get to that. And we have 3 minutes left, a little bit less than 3 minutes. So in a minute, after you tell me about what do you see are the prospects for a revived Labor Party organization in the near future?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, a lot of the momentum moved into the sort of the Bernie Sanders campaign, which created, you know, I mean, I have to, you know, Bernie, you know, did more to advance this program, you know, than anybody else that, you know, has been able to do this in years. So, you know, now we're kind of stuck at this point. We were defeated inside the Democratic Party. We got to get Trump out of the way. I mean, I think that's job one. You know, the fascist maniac has got to be pushed out of office before, you know, we lose our democracy. But then, you know, we're gonna be facing a new strategic situation in 2021, and it, you know, either there will be, you know, such powerful momentum for change, you know, that the Democratic Party responds to it, which I think is unlikely, or the issues that drove millions of Americans to support the Bernie Sanders campaign will continue to, you know, push us towards a more independent political vision. So,
okay,
you know, I think that we're heading for a real flex point coming up in 2021 and beyond.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the economic crisis brought on by the public health crisis is not going away, and the solutions that are likely to emerge from a Democratic administration are not going to solve the crisis.
Yeah. So, and really quick, we have about 30 seconds left.
Mm.
Can you tell us a little bit about the labor campaign for single payer?
labor campaign for single payer is, you know, tries to advance that issue within the labor movement. I see it as a wedge issue, a key issue that really talks about, you know, a central issue that would make life more secure for working people. And it sort of pulls together some of the most thoughtful elements of the labor movement. And we're having our next virtual national conference, January 23rd and 24th. And people can find out, we'll be posting sometime after the election, we'll be posting more information on our website, which is laborforsinglepayer.org.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, both for your work to create a labor party and your ongoing work with labor for a single payer. Thanks so much.
Chris. Great to be here.
Between a president and a king, the corruption, the obstruction, you try to get away with everything. We know the difference between the truth and the lies. We're calling you out now. Then beneath November skies, we're gonna vote your asses out. We're gonna make a world where all our voices count. We'll keep fighting back in every way. And then we'll vote your asses out. We know the difference between a leader and a fake. You failed in this pandemic. Now all our lives are at stake. You held up the Bible. Then you threatened to kill. We'll remember in November. Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, Emmett Till.
Okay, and that was Emma's Revolution. Funny song. With us on the line from Washington, D.C. is Mark Grunberg, and this is Washington Window on Workers. I'm Judy Ansel. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Judy.
Did you hear that song?
Yes, I did. We may wind up with a revolution if something goes haywire after November 3rd.
Right, so that's what we want to talk about. We want to talk about what preparations are unions and allied organizations making in case Trump loses and refuses to step down. So what have you found around the country?
What I found is they're running the gamut. It goes all the way from hitting the streets and hitting the courts on one end. That would be the more moderate folks. To the folks at the Central Labor Council in Rochester, New York, are calling for a general strike, and I believe there's also a local in Western Massachusetts of SEIU that's doing the same thing. But basically, most of the activity seems to be around protecting voters from intimidation. In other words, from the goons who might try to keep them from voting, and then if they are intimidated, Send in the lawyers, send in their own people to make sure that the folks can vote. It's a wide range, but that's sort of in the center of it.
Right. So what's the AFL-CIO doing, do you know?
The AFL-CIO has been working with other groups in that sort of central part. They've called for volunteers. They're going to send them to polling places to make sure that people can vote. And then after that, then they're going to figure out sort of what to do next. Right now they're concentrating on making sure people can vote and not be intimidated out of voting.
Well, there's several organizations that are aimed at protecting the vote and aimed at making sure it gets counted. One of them I ran across is the Labor Action to Defend Democracy, which is is talking about making plans for after the vote. What else do you know?
Well, I'm also seeing a lot of organizations are setting up voter hotlines. They're setting up flying squads of people to come and physically protect voters if necessary. And I don't mean getting into fights with the opposition, but if something goes haywire, you call a hotline. The hotline dispatches people to either defuse the situation or call the appropriate authorities. Things like that.
Where is that? Where are they doing that? Do you know?
They're doing that. Well, a lot of it's being done in swing states, especially Pennsylvania. So it seems. But also Ohio, not so much Ohio, Michigan, some of the other, North Carolina, some of the other real close states, Florida. Now, one thing we should note is in several of these states, first of all, the Supreme Court has given the go-ahead in most of them for mail-in voting and extended deadlines for when the election boards can get the mail-in ballots.
Right.
In other words, you got to postmark it by November 3rd, but for instance, in North Carolina, if it gets to the elections board by November 12th, they can still count it. Pennsylvania, it's November 6th. Either way, the mail-in ballot counts. And that's the other thing that people have been able to do to avoid this intimidation. There is a record. We are at 72 million and counting mail-in ballots around the country so far. It shattered every single record, and in most of these states, especially swing states, it's even higher.
So who's going to win, Mark?
Who's going to win? Well, everybody's crossing their fingers that Biden's going to win, but you know there are going to be tight races, and I'm going to quote the Secretary of State from Washington State that's been doing mail-in ballots for 20 years. She's a moderate Republican. She says, don't expect an immediate outcome on the night of November 3rd.
Right. Well, we won't, although I will announce that we're going to be doing election night coverage with Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! On Tuesday night. We think that's a proposal at this point. And KKFI does not, we're nonpartisan, and we do not endorse candidates. But thank you very much, Mark Ruhnberg. We'll talk to you next month.
Okay, and if you do get Amy Goodman, let me know, because I've always enjoyed listening to Democracy Now! So.
Well, tune in to KKFI from Washington, D.C., and you'll be able to get the coverage.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thanks. And that's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is going to be, it's kind of tentative now, but it's going to be about the book Cast, and we're also going to be talking about whether it's now time for a shorter work week. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special, and we're out of here.
Said to me, there is no disgrace in standing side by side with working people, sweating for an honest wage.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI. Never to acknowledge the conditions where Okay, and stay tuned for the Thursday night special, which is a program by the Kansas City Public Theater. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.